This book is a work of fiction. Any references to historical events, real people, or real places are used fictitiously. Other names, characters, places, and events are products of the author's imagination, and any resemblance to actual events or places or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental. Simon & Schuster Audio presents Sleeping Beauties, a novel by Stephen King and Owen King, read by Marin Ireland, featuring a conversation with Stephen King and Owen King.
In remembrance of Sandra Bland. It makes no difference if you're rich or poor, or if you're smart or dumb. A woman's place in this old world is under some man's thumb. And if you're born a woman, you're born to be hurt. You're born to be stepped on, lied to, cheated on, and treated like dirt. Sandy Posey, Born a Woman. Lyrics by Martha Sharp.
I say you can't not be bothered by a square of light.
Rhys Marie Dempster, inmate number 460-2597-2, Dueling Correctional Facility for Women. She was warned. She was given an explanation. Nevertheless, she persisted. Senator Addison Mitch McConnell, speaking of Senator Elizabeth Warren.
The moth makes Evie laugh. It lands on her bare forearm and she brushes her index finger lightly across the brown and gray waves that color its wings.
Hello, gorgeous, she tells the moth.
It lifts away. Upward, upward, and upward the moth goes and is swallowed by a slice of the sun tangled amid the glossy green leaves 20 feet above Evie's place among the roots on the ground. A coppery red rope leaks from a black socket at the center of the trunk and twists between plates of bark. Evie doesn't trust the snake, obviously. She's had trouble with him before. Her moth and 10,000 others surge from the treetop in a crackling, dun-colored cloud. The swarm rolls across the sky in the direction of the sickly, second-growth pines on the other side of the meadow. She rises to follow. Stalks crunch under her steps, and the waist-high grass scrapes her bare skin. As she approaches the sad, mostly logged-over wood, she detects the first chemical smells. Ammonia, benzene, petroleum, so many others. 10,000 nicks on a single patch of flesh, and relinquishes the hope she had not realized she harbored. Webs spill from her footprints and sparkle in the morning light.
Part 1. The Old Triangle. In the female prison, there are 70 women. I wish it was with them that I did dwell. Then that old triangle could jingle jangle along the banks of the Royal Canal. Brendan Behan. Chapter 1. 1. Rhee asked Jeanette if she ever watched the square of light from the window. Jeanette said she didn't. Rhee was in the top bunk, Jeanette in the bottom. They were both waiting for the cells to unlock for breakfast. It was another morning. It seemed that Jeanette's cellmate had made a study of the square. Rhee explained that the square started on the wall opposite the window, slid down, 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 then slopped over the surface of their desk, and finally made it out onto the floor. As Jeanette could now see, it was right there in the middle of the floor, bright as anything. Rhee, Jeanette said, I just can't be bothered with a square of light.
I say you can't not be bothered by a square of light.
Rhee made the honking noise that was how she expressed amusement. Jeanette said, okay, whatever the fuck that means. And her cellmate just honked some more. Rhee was okay, but she was like a toddler, how silence made her anxious. Rhee was in for credit fraud, forgery, and drug possession with intent to sell. She hadn't been much good at any of them, which had brought her here. Jeanette was in for manslaughter. On a winter night in 2005, she had stabbed her husband Damien in the groin with a clutch head screwdriver, and because he was high, he'd just sat in an armchair and let himself bleed to death. She had been high too, of course.
I was watching the clock, Rhee said. Timed it. 22 minutes for the light to move from the window to there on the floor.
You should call Guinness, said Jeanette.
Last night I had a dream about eating chocolate cake with Michelle Obama, and she was pissed. That's gonna make you fat, Rhee. But she was eating the cake, too.
Rhee honked.
Nah, I didn't. Made that up. Actually, I dreamed about this teacher I had. She kept telling me I wasn't in the right classroom, and I kept telling her I was in the right classroom, and she'd say, okay, and then teach some, and tell me I wasn't in the right room, and I'd say, no, I was in the right room, and we went around like that. It was more exasperating than anything. What'd you dream, Jeanette?
Jeanette tried to remember, but she couldn't. Her new medication seemed to have thickened her sleep. Before, sometimes she had nightmares about Damien. He'd usually look the way he did the morning after, when he was dead, his skin that streaky blue, like wet ink. Jeanette had asked Dr. Norcross if he thought the dreams had to do with guilt. The doctor squinted at her in that are-you-fucking-serious way that used to drive her nuts, but that she had come around on, and then he had asked her if she was of the opinion that bunnies had floppy ears. Yeah, okay. Got it. Anyhow, Jeanette didn't miss those dreams. Sorry, Rhee, I got nothing. Whatever I dreamed, it's gone. Somewhere out in the second floor hall of B-Wing, shoes were clapping along the cement. An officer making some last-minute check before the doors opened. Jeanette closed her eyes. She made up a dream. In it, the prison was a ruin. Lush vines climbed the ancient cell walls and sifted in the spring breeze. The ceiling was half gone, gnawed away by time so that only an overhang remained. A couple of tiny lizards ran over a pile of rusty debris. Butterflies tumbled in the air. Rich scents of earth and leaf spiced what remained of the cell. Bobby was impressed, standing beside her at a hole in the wall, looking in. His mom was an archaeologist. She'd discovered this place.
You'd think you can be on a game show if you have a criminal record?
The vision collapsed. Jeanette moaned. Well, it had been nice while it lasted. Life was definitely better on the pills. There was a calm, easy place she could find. Give the doc his due, better living through chemistry. Jeanette reopened her eyes. Rhee was goggling at Jeanette. Prison didn't have much to say for it, but a girl like Rhee, maybe she was safer inside. Out in the world, she'd just as likely walk into traffic, or sell dope to a narc who looked like nothing but a narc, which she had done. What's wrong? Rhee asked. Nothing. I was just in paradise, that's all, and your big mouth blew it up.
What?
Never mind. Listen, I think there should be a game show where you can only play if you do have a criminal record. We could call it Lying for Prizes.
I like that a lot. How would it work?
Jeanette sat up and yawned, shrugged. I'll have to think about it. You know, work out the rules. Their house was as it always had been and always would be. World without end, amen. A cell 10 steps long with 4 steps between the bunks and the door. The walls were smooth, oatmeal-colored cement. Their curling snapshots and postcards were held, little that anyone cared to look, with blobs of green sticky tack in the single approved space. There was a small metal desk set against one wall and a short metal shelving unit set against the opposite wall. To the left of the door was the steel toilet where they had to squat, each looking away to lend a poor illusion of privacy.
The cell door, its double-paned window at eye level, gave a view of the short corridor that ran through B-Wing. Every inch and object within the cell were sauced in the pervasive odors of prison. Sweat, mildew, Lysol. Against her will, Jeanette finally took note of the sun square between the beds. It was almost to the door, but it wouldn't get any farther, would it? Unless a screw put a key in the lock or opened the cell from the booth, it was trapped in here just as they were.
And who would host? Ree asked. Every game show needs a host. Also, what kind of prizes? The prizes have to be good. Details! We gotta figure out all the details, Jeanette.
Ree had her head propped up and was winding a finger around in her tight, bleached curls as she looked at Jeanette. Near the top of Ree's forehead, there was a patch of scar tissue that resembled a grill mark, three deep parallel lines. Although Jeanette didn't know what had caused the scar, she could guess who had made it. A man. Maybe her father, maybe her brother, maybe a boyfriend, maybe a guy she'd never seen before and never would see again. Among the inmates of Dueling Correctional, there was, to put it lightly, very little history of prize winning. Lots of history with bad guys, though. What could you do? You could feel sorry for yourself. You could hate yourself, or you could hate everyone. You could get high sniffing cleaning products. You could do whatever you wanted within your admittedly limited options, but the situation wouldn't change. Your next turn to spin the great big shiny wheel of fortune would arrive no sooner than your next parole hearing. Jeanette wanted to put as much arm as she could into hers. She had her son to think about. There was a resounding thud as the officer in the booth opened 62 locks. It was 6:30 a.m. Everyone out of their cells for headcount. I don't know, Ree. You think about it, Jeanette said, and I'll think about it, and then we'll exchange notes later. She swung her legs out of bed and stood. 2. A few miles from the prison, on the deck of the Norcross home, Anton the pool guy was skimming for dead bugs. The pool had been Dr. Clinton Norcross's 10th anniversary present to his wife, Lila. The sight of Anton often made Clint question the wisdom of this gift. This morning was one of those times. Anton was shirtless, and for two good reasons. First, it was going to be a hot day. Second, his abdomen was a rock. He was ripped, was Anton, the pool guy. He looked like a stud on the cover of a romance novel. If you shot bullets at Anton's abdomen, you'd want to do it from an angle in case of a ricochet. What did he eat? Mountains of pure protein? What was his workout? Cleaning the Augean stables? Anton glanced up, smiling from under the shimmering panes of his wayfarers. With his free hand, he waved at Clint, who was watching from the second floor window of the master bathroom. Jesus Christ, man, Clint said quietly to himself. He waved back. Have a heart. Clint sidled away from the window. In the mirror on the closed bathroom door, there appeared a 48-year-old white male, BA from Cornell, MD from NYU, modest love handles from Starbucks Grande Mochas. His salt-and-pepper beard was less woodcutter virile, more lumpen one-legged sea captain. That his age and softening body should come as any kind of a surprise struck Clint as ironic. He had never had much patience with male vanity, especially the middle-aged variety, and cumulative professional experience had, if anything, trimmed that particular fuse even shorter. In fact, what Clint thought of as the great turning point of his medical career had occurred 18 years earlier, in 1999, when a prospective patient named Paul Montpelier had come to the young doctor with a crisis of sexual ambition. He had asked Montpelier, "When you say sexual ambition, what do you mean?" Ambitious people sought promotions. You couldn't really become vice president of sex. It was a peculiar euphemism. I mean, Montpelier appeared to weigh various descriptors. He cleared his throat and settled on, "I still want to do it. I still want to go for it." Clint said,
That doesn't seem unusually ambitious. It seems normal. Fresh from his psych residency and not yet softening, this was only Clint's second day in the office, and Montpelier was just his second patient. His first patient had been a teenager with some anxieties about her college applications. Pretty quickly, however, it had emerged that the girl had received a 1570 on her SATs. Clint pointed out that this was excellent, and there had been no need for treatment or a second appointment. Cured, he had dashed off on the bottom of the yellow legal pad he used to take notes on. Seated in the leatherette armchair opposite Clint, Paul Montpelier had that day worn a white sweater vest and pleated pants. He sat in a hunch with an ankle over his knee, hanging onto his dress shoe with one hand as he spoke. Clint had seen him park a candy red sports car in the lot outside the low-slung office building. Working high up the food chain of the coal industry had made it possible for him to buy a car like that, but his long, careworn face reminded Clint of the Beagle Boys, who used to bedevil Scrooge McDuck in the old comic strips. "My wife says, well, not in so many words, but, you know, the meaning is clear, the, subtext. She wants me to let it go, let my sexual ambition go." He jerked his chin upward. Clint followed his gaze. There was a fan rotating on the ceiling. If Montpelier sent his sexual ambition up there, it was going to get cut off.
"Let's back up, Paul. How did this subject come up between you and your wife in the first place? Where did this start?"
"I had an affair. That was the precipitating incident. And Rhoda, my wife, kicked me out. I explained it wasn't about her. It was about, I had a need, you know? Men have needs women do not always understand." Montpelier rolled his head around on his neck. He made a frustrated hiss.
"I don't want to get divorced. There's a part of me that feels like she's the one who needs to come to terms with this, with me."
The man's sadness and desperation were real, and Clint could imagine the pain brought on by his sudden displacement, living out of a suitcase, eating watery omelets by himself in a diner. It wasn't clinical depression, but it was significant, and deserving of respect and care, even though he might have brought the situation on himself. Montpelier leaned over his growing stomach. "Let's be frank. I'm pushing 50 here, Dr. Norcross. My best sex days are already gone. I gave those up for her. Surrendered them to her. I changed diapers. I drove to all the games and competitions and built up the college funds. I checked every box on the questionnaire of marriage. So why can't we come to some sort of agreement here? Why does it have to be so terrible and divisive?" Clint hadn't replied. Just waited. "Last week, I was at Miranda's. She's the woman I've been sleeping with. We did it in the kitchen. We did it in her bedroom. We almost managed a third time in the shower. I was happy as heck. Endorphins! And then I went home and we had a good family dinner and played Scrabble and everyone else felt great too. Where is the problem? It's a manufactured problem, is what I think. Why can't I have some freedom here? Is it too much to ask? Is it so outrageous?" For a few seconds, no one spoke. Montpelier regarded Clint. Good words swam and darted around in Clint's head like tadpoles. They would be easy enough to catch, but he still held back. Behind his patient, propped against the wall, was the framed Hockney print that Lila had given Clint to warm the place up. He planned to hang it later that day. Beside the print were his half-unpacked boxes of medical texts. Someone needs to help this man, the young doctor found himself thinking, and they ought to do it in a nice, quiet room like this. But should that person be Clinton R. Norcross, M.D.? He had, after all, worked awfully hard to become a doctor, and there had been no college fund to help Clint along. He had grown up under difficult circumstances and paid his own way, sometimes in more than money. To get through, he had done things he had never told his wife about, and never would. Was this what he had done those things for? To treat the sexually ambitious Paul Montpelier? A tender grimace of apology creased Montpelier's wide face. "Oh, boy. Shoot. I'm not doing this right. Am I?" "You're doing it fine," Clint said.
and for the next 30 minutes he consciously put his doubts aside. They stretched the thing out. They looked at it from all sides. They discussed the difference between desire and need. They talked about Mrs. Montpelier and her pedestrian, in Montpelier's opinion, bedroom preferences. They even took a surprisingly candid detour to visit Paul Montpelier's earliest adolescent sexual experience, when he had masturbated using the jaws of his little brother's stuffed crocodile. Clint, according to his professional obligation, asked Montpelier if he'd ever considered harming himself. No. He wondered how Montpelier would feel if the roles were reversed. He insisted that he'd tell her to do what she needed to do. Where did Montpelier see himself in 5 years? That's when the man in the white sweater vest started to weep. At the end of the session, Montpelier said he was already looking forward to the next, and as soon as he departed, Clint rang his service. He directed them to refer all of his calls to a psychiatrist in Maylock, the next town over. The operator asked him for how long.
"Until snow flurries are reported in hail," said Clint.
From the window, he watched Montpelier back up his candy red sports car and pull out of the lot, never to be seen again. Next, he called Lila.
"Hello, Dr. Norcross."
The feeling her voice gave him was what people meant, or should have meant, when they said their hearts sang. She asked him how his second day was going.
"The least self-aware man in America dropped in for a visit," he said.
"Oh, my father was there? I bet the Hockney print confused him." She was quick, his wife, as quick as she was warm, and as tough as she was quick. Lila loved him, but she never stopped bumping him off his mark. Clint thought he probably needed that. Probably most men did. "Ha ha," Clint had said. "Listen, though, that opening you mentioned at the prison, who did you hear about that from?" There was a second or two of silence while his wife thought over the question's implications. She responded with a question of her own.
"Clint, is there something you need to tell me?"
Clint had not even considered that she might be disappointed by his decision to dump the private practice for the government one. He was sure she wouldn't be. Thank God for Lila. 3. To apply the electric shaver to the gray stubble under his nose, Clint had to twist his face up so he looked like Quasimodo. A snow-white wire poked out from his left nostril. Anton could juggle barbells all he wanted, but white nostril hairs waited for every man, as did those that appeared in the ears. Clint managed to buzz this one away. He had never been built like Anton. Not even his last year in high school when the court granted him his independence and he lived on his own and ran track. Clint had been rangier, skinnier, stomach toneless but flat like his son Jared. In his memory, Paul Montpelier was pudgier than the version of himself that Clint saw this morning. But he looked more like one than the other. Where was he now, Paul Montpelier? Had the crisis been resolved? Probably. Time healed all wounds. Of course, as some wag had pointed out, it also wounds all heals. Clint had no more than the normal, i.e. healthy, totally conscious, and fantasy-based, longing to screw outside of his marriage. His situation wasn't, contra Paul Montpelier, a crisis of any kind. It was normal life as he understood it, a second look on the street at a pretty girl, an instinctive peek at a woman in a short skirt exiting a car, an almost subconscious lunging of lust for one of the models decorating The Price is Right. It was a doleful thing, he supposed, doleful and perhaps a bit comic, the way age dragged you farther and farther from the body you liked the best and left those old instincts, not ambitions, thank God, behind, like the smell of cooking long after dinner has been consumed. And was he judging all men by himself? No, he was a member of the tribe, that was all. It was women who were the real riddles. Clint smiled at himself in the mirror. He was clean-shaven, he was alive. He was about the same age as Paul Montpelier had been in 1999. To the mirror, he said, "Hey, Anton, go fuck yourself."
The bravado was false, but at least he made the effort. From the bedroom beyond the bathroom door, he heard a lock click, a drawer open, a thump as Lila deposited her gun belt in the drawer, shut it, and clicked it locked again. He heard her sigh and yawn. In case she was already asleep, he dressed without speaking, and instead of sitting on the bed to put on his shoes, Clint picked them up to carry downstairs. Lila cleared her throat.
It's okay, I'm still awake.
Clint wasn't sure that was entirely true. Lila had gotten as far as unsnapping the top button of her uniform pants before flopping on the bed. She hadn't even climbed under the blankets.
You must be exhausted. I'll be right out. Everyone all right on Mountain?
The previous night, she texted that there was a crack-up on the Mountain Rest Road. Don't stay up. While this wasn't unheard of, it was unusual. He and Jared had grilled steaks and polished off a couple of anchor steams on the deck. Trailer came unhitched from pet whatever, the chain store, went over on its side, blocked the whole road, cat litter and dog food all over. We ended up having to bulldoze it out of the way. That sounds like a shit show. He bent down and put a kiss on her cheek. Hey, you want to start jogging together? The idea had just occurred to him, and he was immediately cheered. You couldn't stop your body from breaking down and thickening, but you could fight back. Lila opened her right eye, pale green in the dimness of the room with the curtains pulled. Not this morning. Of course not, Clint said. He hung over her, thinking she was going to kiss him back, but she just told him to have a good day and make sure Jared took out the trash. The eye rolled closed. A flash of green, and gone. 4. The smell in the shed was almost too much to bear. Evie's bare skin pebbled up, and she had to fight not to retch. The stench was a mingling of scorched chemicals, old leaf smoke, and food that had spoiled. One of the moths was in her hair, nestled and pulsing reassurance against her scalp. She breathed as shallowly as she could and scanned around. The prefab shed was set up for cooking drugs. In the center of the space was a gas stove attached by yellowish tubes to a pair of white canisters. On a counter against the wall, there were trays, jugs of water, an open package of Ziploc bags, test tubes, pieces of cork, countless dead matches, a one-hitter with a charred bowl, and a utility sink connected to a hose that ran away and out under the netting that Evie had pulled back to enter. Empty bottles and dented cans on the floor. A wobbly-looking lawn chair with a Dale Earnhardt Jr. logo stamped on the back. Balled up in the corner, a gray checked shirt. Evie shook the stiffness and at least some of the filth from the shirt, then drew it on. The tails hung down over her bottom and thighs. Until recently, this garment had belonged to someone disgusting. A California-shaped stain running down the chest area reported that the disgusting person liked mayonnaise. She squatted down by the tanks and yanked the yellowing tubes loose. Then she turned the knobs on the propane tanks a quarter inch each. Outside the shed again, netting drawn closed behind her, Evie paused to take deep breaths of the fresher air. 300 feet or so down the wooded embankment stood a trailer, fronted by a gravel apron with a truck and two cars parked on it. 3 gutted rabbits, one of which was still dripping, hung from a clothesline alongside a few faded pairs of panties and a jean jacket. Puffs of wood smoke rose from the trailer's chimney. Back the way she came, through the thin forest and across the field, the tree was no longer visible. She wasn't alone, though. Moths furred the roof of the shed, fluttering and shifting. Evie started down the embankment. Deadwood branches stabbed her feet and a rock cut her heel. She didn't break stride. She was a fast healer. By the clothesline, she paused to listen. She heard a man laughing, a television playing, and 10,000 worms in the little patch of ground around her, sweetening the soil. The rabbit that was still bleeding rolled its foggy eyes at her. She asked it what the deal was. 3 men, 1 woman, the
the rabbit said. A single fly flew from its tattered black lips, buzzed around, and zoomed into the cavity of a limp ear. Evie heard the fly pinging around in there. She didn't blame the fly. It was doing what a fly was made to do, but she mourned the rabbit, who did not deserve such a dirty fate. While Evie loved all animals, she was especially fond of the smaller ones, those creepers of meadow and leapers of deadfall, the fragile winged and the scuttling. She cupped her hand behind the dying rabbit's head and gently brought its crusted black mouth to hers.
"Thank you,"
Evie whispered, and let it be quiet. 5. One benefit of living in this particular corner of Appalachia was that you could afford a decent-sized home on 2 government salaries. The Norcross home was a 3-bedroom contemporary in a development of similar houses. The houses were handsome, spacious without being grotesque, had lawns adequate for playing catch, and views that in the green seasons were lush, hilly, and leafy. What was a little depressing about the development was that even at reduced prices, almost half of its rather attractive houses were empty. The demonstrator home at the top of the hill was the one exception. That one was kept clean and shiny and furnished. Lila said it was just a matter of time before a meth head broke into it and tried to set up shop. Clint had told her not to worry. He knew the sheriff. In fact, they had a semi-regular thing. "She's into old guys?" Lila had replied, batting her eyes and pressing herself to his hip. The upstairs of the Norcross house contained the master bedroom, Jared's room, and a 3rd bedroom, which the 2 adults used as a home office. On the 1st floor, the kitchen was wide and open, separated from the family room by a counter bar. At the right side of the family room, behind closed French doors, was their little-used dining room. Clint drank coffee and read the New York Times on his iPad at the kitchen bar. An earthquake in North Korea had caused an untold number of casualties. The North Korean government insisted that the damage was minor due to superior architecture, but there was cell phone footage of dusty bodies and rubble. An oil rig was burning in the Gulf of Aden, probably as a result of sabotage, but no one was claiming responsibility. Every country in the region had done the diplomatic equivalent of a bunch of boys who knock out a window playing baseball and run home without looking back. In the New Mexico desert, the FBI was on day 44 of its standoff with a militia led by Kinsman Brightleaf, nay, Scott David Winstead, Jr. This happy band refused to pay its taxes, accept the legality of the Constitution, or surrender its stockpile of automatic weapons. When people learned that Clint was a psychiatrist, they often entreated him to diagnose the mental diseases of politicians, celebrities, and other notables. He usually demurred, but in this instance, he felt comfortable making a long-distance diagnosis. Kinsman Brightleaf was suffering from some kind of dissociative disorder. At the bottom of the front page was a photo of a hollow-faced young woman standing in front of an Appalachian shack with an infant in her arms. Cancer in coal country. This made Clint recall the chemical spill in a local river 5 years ago. It had caused a week-long shutdown of the water supply. Everything was supposedly fine now, but Clint and his family stuck to bottled drinking water just to be sure. Sun warmed his face. He looked out toward the big twin elm trees at the back of the yard, beyond the edge of the pool deck. The elms made him think of brothers, of sisters, of husbands and wives. He was sure that beneath the ground, their roots were mortally entwined. Dark green mountains knuckled up in the distance. Clouds seemed to be melting on the pan of the fair blue sky. Birds flew and sang. Wasn't it a hell of a shame, the way good country got wasted on folks? That was another thing that an old wag had told him. Clint liked to believe it wasn't wasted on him. He had never expected to own a view like this one. He wondered how decrepit and soft he'd have to grow before it made sense, the good luck that some people got and the bad luck that saddled others.
"Hey, Dad, how's the world? Anything good happening?"
Clint turned from the window to see Jared stroll into the kitchen, zipping up his backpack.
Hold on. He flicked through a couple of electronic pages. He didn't want to send his son off to school with an oil spill, a militia, or cancer. Ah, just the thing. Physicists are theorizing that the universe might go on forever. Jared pawed through the snack cabinet, found a Nutribar, stuck it in his pocket. And you think that's good? Can you explain what you mean? Clint considered for a second before he realized that his son was busting his balls. I see what you did there. As he looked over at Jared, he used his middle finger to scratch at his eyelid. You don't have to be shy about this, Dad. You have son-father privilege. It all stays between us. Jared helped himself to the coffee. He took it black, the way Clint used to when his stomach was young. The coffee maker was near the sink, where the window opened onto the deck. Jared sipped and took in the view.
Wow. Are you sure you should leave Mom here alone with Anton?
Please go, Clint said. Go to school and learn something. His son had grown up on him. Dog had been Jared's first word, spoken so that it rhymed with brogue.
Dog, dog.
He had been a likable boy, inquisitive and well-intentioned, and he had developed into a likable young man, still inquisitive and well-intentioned. Clint took pride in how the safe, secure home they had provided Jared had allowed him to become more and more himself. It hadn't been like that for Clint. He had been toying with the idea of giving the kid condoms, but he didn't want to talk to Lila about it, and he didn't want to encourage anything. He didn't want to be thinking about it at all. Jared insisted he and Mary were just friends, and maybe Jared even believed it. Clint saw how he looked at the girl, though, and it was the way you looked at someone you wanted to be your very, very close friend.
Little League Shake, Jared said and held out his hands. You still know it?
Clint did. Bump fists, pop and lock thumbs, twist hands, smooth down the palms, then clap them together twice overhead. Though it had been a long time, it went perfectly, and they both laughed. It put a shine on the morning. Jared was out and gone before Clint remembered that he was supposed to tell his son to take out the trash. Another part of getting older. You forgot what you wanted to remember and remembered what you wanted to forget. He could be the old wag that said that. He should get a pillow stitched with it. 6. Having been on good report for 60 days, Jeanette Sorley had common room privileges 3 mornings a week, between 8 and 9 in the morning. In reality, that meant between 8 and 8:55, because her 6-hour shift in the carpentry shed began at 9. There she would spend her time inhaling varnish through a thin cotton mask and turning out chair legs. For this, she made $3 an hour. The money went into an account that would be paid to her by check when she got out. Inmates called their work accounts free parking, like in Monopoly. The chairs themselves were sold in the prison store across Route 17. Some went for $60, most for $80, and the prison sold a lot of them. Jeanette didn't know where that money went and didn't care. Having common room privileges, though, she did care about. There was a big TV, board games, and magazines. There was also a snack machine and a soda machine that only worked on quarters, and inmates did not have quarters. Quarters were considered contraband, catch 22, but at least you could window shop. Plus, the common room became, at appointed times of the week, the visitor's room, and veteran visitors, like Jeanette's son Bobby, knew to bring lots of quarters. This morning, she was sitting beside Angel Fitzroy, watching the morning report on WTRF Channel 7 out of Wheeling. The news was the usual stew, a drive-by shooting, a transformer fire, a woman arrested for assaulting another woman at the monster truck jam, the state legislature having an argle-bargle over a new men's prison that had been built on a mountaintop removal site and appeared to have structural problems. On the national front, the Kinsman Brightleaf siege continued. On the other side of the globe, thousands were thought dead in a North Korean earthquake, and doctors in Australia were reporting an outbreak of sleeping sickness that seemed to affect only women.
That'd be meth, Angel Fitzroy said.
She was nibbling a Twix she had found in the snack machine's dispenser tray, making it last.
Which? The sleeping women, the chick at the monster truck jam, or the reality show type guy?
Could be all, but I was thinking of the chick at the jam. I was at one of those once, and damn near everybody on except the kiddies is coked up or smoked up. You want some of this?
She cupped the remains of the Twix in her hand, in case Officer Lampley was currently monitoring one of the common room cameras, and offered it to Jeanette.
It ain't so stale as some of them in there.
I'll pass, Jeanette said.
Sometimes I see something makes me wish I was dead, Angel said matter-of-factly. Or wish everybody else was. Look at that.
She pointed to a new poster between the snack machine and the soft drink dispenser. It showed a sand dune with footprints leading away, seemingly into infinity. Below the photo was this message. The challenge is getting there.
The guy got there, but where did he go? Where is that place?
Angel wanted to know. Iraq? Jeanette asked. He's probably at the next oasis.
Nope. He's dead of heat stroke. Just laying out there just where you can't see. Eyes all bugging out and skin black as a top hat.
She didn't smile. Angel was a tweaker and serious country. Bark chewing, baptized in a moonshine still country. Assault was what they got her for, but Jeanette guessed Angel could have hit most of the categories on a criminal scorecard. Her face was all bones and angles. It looked hard enough to break up pavement. She had spent a goodly amount of time in Sea Wing during her stay at dueling. In Sea Wing, you only got out 2 hours a day. It was bad girl country, was Sea Wing. I don't think you turn black, even if you die of heat stroke in Iraq, Jeanette said. It could be a mistake to disagree, even humorously, with Angel, who had what Dr. Norcross liked to call anger issues, but this morning Jeanette felt like living dangerously.
My point is, that's a crock of shit, Angel said. The challenge is just living through fucking today, as you probably well know.
Who do you think put it up, Dr. Norcross? Angel snorted.
Norcross has got more sense. Now that's Warden Coates. Janice. Honey's big on motivation. Seen the one in her office?
Jeanette had. An oldie, but not a goodie. It showed a kitten hanging from a tree branch. Hang in there, baby, indeed. Most of the kitties in this place had already fallen off their branches. Some were out of their trees. The TV news was now showing the mugshot of an escaped convict.
Oh, man, Angel said. He put the lie to black is beautiful, don't he?
Jeanette did not comment. The fact was, she still liked guys with mean eyes. She was working on it with Dr. Norcross, but for the time being, she was stuck with this attraction to fellows who looked like they might at any moment decide to take a wire whisk to your bare back while you were in the shower.
McDavid's in one of Norcross's babysitting cells in A-Wing, Angel said.
Where'd you hear that? Kitty McDavid was one of Jeanette's favorite people, smart and feisty. Rumor was that Kitty had rolled with a heavy crowd on the outside, but there's no real meanness in her, except for the kind that was self-directed. She had been a deeply dedicated cutter at some point in the past. The scars were on her breasts, sides, upper thighs. And she was prone to periods of depression, although whatever meds Norcross had her on seemed to have been helping with that.
You want all the news? You got to get in here early. I heard it from her.
Angel pointed at Maura Dunbarton, an elderly trustee who was in for life. Maura was now placing magazines from her wheelie cart on the tables, doing it with infinite care and precision. Her white hair stood out around her head in a filmy corona. Her legs were clad in heavy support hose the color of cotton candy.
Maura!
Jeanette called, but low. Shouting in common room was strictly verboten, except by kids on visiting days and inmates on the monthly party nights.
Walk this way, girlfriend.
Maura rolled her cart slowly toward them.
Got a 17, she said. Either of you interested?
I wasn't interested when I was 17, Jeanette said.
What's up with Kitty?
Screaming half the night, Maura said. Surprised you didn't hear her.
They pulled her out of her cell, gave her a needle, and put her in A. Sleeping now.
Screaming what?
Angel asked.
Or just screaming?
Screaming that the Black Queen is coming, Mora said. Says she'll be here today.
Aretha coming to put on a show?
Angel asked.
She's the only Black Queen I know.
Mora paid no attention. She was gazing at the blue-eyed blonde on the cover of the magazine.
Sure, neither of you wants this 17. There's some nice party dresses.
Angel said.
I don't wear no dress like that unless I have my tiara.
And laughed. Has Dr. Norcross seen Kitty? Jeanette asked. Not in yet, Mora said. I had a party dress once. Real pretty blue, poofy. My husband burned a hole in it with the iron. It was an accident. He was trying to help. No one ever taught him how to iron, though. Most men never learn. And he won't now, that's for sure.
Neither of them replied. What Mora Dunbarton did to her husband and two children was well known. It happened 30 years ago, but some crimes are unforgettable.
7. 3 or 4 years earlier, or maybe 5 or 6, the aughts had sort of sprinted away on her and the landmarks were hazy. In a parking lot behind a Kmart in North Carolina, a man told Tiffany Jones she was headed for trouble. Vaporous as the last decade and a half had been, this moment had stayed with her. Seagulls were screeching and picking at the trash around the Kmart loading dock. Drizzle streaked the window glass of the Jeep she was sitting in, which belonged to the guy who said she was headed for trouble. The guy was Malfuzz. She had just given him a blowjob. What happened was he caught her shoplifting deodorant. The quid pro quo they'd agreed on had been fairly straightforward and unsurprising. She gave him oral sex, he let her go. He was a beefy son of a bitch. It had been quite an operation. Getting access to his dick while negotiating his gut and thighs and the steering wheel of his car. But Tiffany had done a lot of things, and this was so minor by comparison, it wouldn't even have made the long list, except for what he said.
Gotta be a bummer for you, huh?
A sympathetic grimace spread across his sweaty face as he wiggled around in his seat, trying to yank up his bright red plastic jogging pants that were probably the only thing he could get in his pig size.
You know you are headed for trouble when you find yourself in a situation like this here where you have to cooperate with somebody like me.
Until this point, Tiffany had assumed that abusers, people like her cousin Truman, must live in denial. If not, how could they go on? How could you hurt or degrade a person when you were fully cognizant of what you were doing? Well, it turned out you could, and men like the pig of a security guard did. It had been a real shock, this realization that abruptly explained so much of her entire shitty life. Tiffany was not sure she had ever gotten over it. 3 or 4 moths rattled around inside the bubble of the light fixture set above the counter. The bulb was burned out. It didn't matter. There was plenty of morning light in the trailer. The moths binged and fluttered, their little shadows bickering. How did they get in there? And by the way, how did she get here? For a while, after some rough times in her late teens, Tiffany had managed to build a life. She had been waiting tables at a bistro in 2006 and making good tips. She had a 2-room apartment in Charlottesville and grew ferns on the balcony. Doing pretty good for a high school dropout. On the weekends, she had liked to rent a big bay horse named Moline, who had a sweet disposition and an easy canter, and go riding at Shenandoah. Now she was in a trailer in East Shitballs, Appalachia, and she was no longer just headed for trouble. She was there. At least the trouble was wrapped in cotton, though. It didn't sting the way you expected trouble to sting, which was maybe the worst thing about it, because you were so far inside, trapped all the way back in the last row of yourself, where you couldn't even... Tiffany heard a thump, and all at once she was on the floor. Her hip throbbed where it had banged against the edge of the counter. Cigarette dangling off his lip, Truman stared down at her.
Earth to crack, whore!
He was in his cowboy boots and boxer shorts and nothing else. The flesh of his torso was as tight as plastic wrap over his ribs.
"Earth to crack whore,"
Truman repeated and clapped his hands in front of her face like she was a bad dog.
"Can't you hear? Someone's knocking on the door."
True was such an asshole that in the part of Tiffany where she was still alive, the part where she occasionally felt the urge to brush her hair or call that Elaine woman from the Planned Parenthood clinic who wanted her to agree to sign up on a list for a lockdown detox, she sometimes regarded him with scientific amazement. True was an asshole standard. Tiffany would ask herself, is so-and-so a bigger asshole than Truman? Few could compare. In fact, so far officially, there was only Donald Trump and cannibals. Truman's record of malfeasance was lengthy. As a boy, he had stuck his finger up his butt and jammed it into the nostrils of smaller kids. Later, he had stolen from his mother, pawned her jewelry and her antiques. He had turned Tiffany onto meth that afternoon he'd swung by to see her at the nice apartment in Charlottesville. His idea of a prank was to poke you in the bare flesh of your shoulder with a lit cigarette while you were sleeping. Truman was a rapist, but had never done time for it. Some assholes just struck lucky. His face was patterned with an uneven growth of red-gold beard, and his eyes were enormous with pupil, but the sneering, unapologetic boy he'd always been was there in the jut of his jaw.
"Crack whore, come in!"
"What?"
Tiffany managed to ask.
"I told you to answer the door, Jesus Christ!"
Truman feinted a punch and she covered her head with her hands. She blinked tears.
"Fuck you,"
she said half-heartedly. She hoped Dr. Flickinger didn't hear. He was in the bathroom. Tiffany liked the doctor. The doc was a trip. He always called her Madame and threw a wink to let her know he wasn't making fun.
"You are a toothless, deaf crack whore," Truman announced, overlooking the fact that he was himself in need of cosmetic dental surgery.
Truman's friend came out of the trailer's bedroom, sat down at the fold-out table, and said,
"Crack whore, phone home."
He giggled at his joke and did an elbow jig. Tiffany couldn't remember his name, but she hoped his mother was super proud of her son who had the South Park poop tattooed on his Adam's apple. A knock at the door. This time Tiffany did register it, a firm double rap.
"Never mind, wouldn't want to trouble you, Tiff. Just sit right there on your dumb ass."
Truman yanked open the door. A woman was standing there in one of Truman's checked shirts, a length of olive-toned leg visible beneath.
"What's this?" Truman asked her. "What you want?"
The voice that answered him was faint.
"Hello, man."
From his seat at the table, Truman's friend called out,
"Are you the Avon lady or what?"
"Listen, honey," Truman said to her, "you're welcome to come in, but I believe I'm gonna need that shirt back."
That made Truman's friend laugh.
"This is amazing. I mean, this is your birthday or what, True?"
From the bathroom, Tiffany heard the flush of the toilet. Dr. Flickinger had finished his business. The woman at the door shot a hand out and grabbed Truman's neck. He made a little wheezing noise. His cigarette popped from his mouth. He reached up and dug his fingers into the visitor's wrist. Tiffany saw the flesh of the woman's hand whiten under the pressure, but she didn't let go. Red spots appeared on Truman's cheekbones. Blood trickled from the gashes his fingernails were making in the woman's wrist. She still didn't let go. The wheezing noise narrowed to a whistle. Truman's free hand found the grip of the Bowie knife tucked into his belt and pulled it loose. The woman stepped into the room, her other hand catching the forearm of Truman's knife hand in mid-stab. She backed him up, slamming him against the opposite wall of the trailer. It happened so quickly that Tiffany was never able to capture the stranger's face, only the screen of her tangled, shoulder-length hair, which was so dark it seemed to have a green tint.
"Whoa, whoa, whoa,"
said Truman's friend, scrabbling for the pistol behind a roll of paper towels and rising up from his chair. On Truman's cheeks, the red spots had expanded into purple clouds.
He was making a noise like sneakers squeaking on hardwood, his grimace slipping into a sad clown droop. His eyes rolled. Tiffany could see his heartbeat pulsing in the taut skin to the left of his breastbone. The woman's strength was astonishing.
"Whoa," Truman's friend said yet again as the woman headbutted Truman.
True's nose broke with a firecracker snap. A thread of blood lashed across the ceiling, a few droplets splashing on the bubble of the light fixture. The moths were going crazy, battering themselves against the fixture, the sound like an ice cube being shaken around in a glass. When Tiffany's eyes slipped back down, she saw the woman swinging Truman's body toward the table. Truman's friend stood and pointed his gun. The crash of a stone bowling ball boomed through the trailer. An irregular-shaped puzzle piece appeared in Truman's forehead. A ragged handkerchief fell across Truman's eye, skin with a section of eyebrow attached, torn loose and hanging down. Blood overspread Truman's sagging mouth and slid down his chin. The flap of skin with his eyebrow on it flopped against his cheek. Tiffany thought of the mop-like sponges at the car wash that swabbed the windshield. A second shot ripped a hole through Truman's shoulder. Blood misted over Tiffany's face, and the woman barreled Truman's corpse into Truman's friend. The table collapsed under the weight of the three bodies. Tiffany couldn't hear her own screaming. Time jumped. Tiffany found herself in the corner of the closet, a raincoat pulled up to her chin. A series of muffled, rhythmic thuds made the trailer sway back and forth on its foundation. Tiffany was cast back to a memory of the Charlottesville Bistro's kitchen all those years earlier, the chef using a mallet to pound veal. The thuds were like that, except much, much heavier. There was a pop of ripping metal and plastic. Then the thuds ceased. The trailer stopped moving. A knock shook the closet door.
"Are you okay?"
It was the woman.
"Go away!"
Tiffany howled.
"The one in the bathroom got out the window. I don't think you have to worry about him."
"What did you do?"
Tiffany sobbed. Truman's blood was on her, and she didn't want to die. The woman didn't answer right away. Not that she needed to. Tiffany had seen what she had done, or seen enough, and heard enough.
"You should rest now," said the woman. "Just rest."
A few seconds later, Tiffany thought she heard, through the sound baffles left by the gunfire, the click of the exterior door shutting. She huddled under the raincoat and moaned Truman's name. He had taught her how to smoke dope. "Take small sips," he said. "You'll feel better." What a liar. What a bastard he had been. What a monster. So why was she crying over him? She couldn't help it. She wished she could, but she couldn't. 8. The Avon lady, who was not an Avon lady, walked away from the trailer and back toward the meth lab. The smell of propane grew stronger with each step until the air was rancid with it. Her footprints appeared behind her, white and small and delicate, shapes that came from nowhere and seemed to be made of milkweed fluff. The hem of her borrowed shirt fluttered around her long thighs. In front of the shed, she plucked up a piece of paper caught in a bush. At the top, in big blue letters, it announced, "Everything is on sale every day." Below this were pictures of refrigerator units, both large and small. Washing machines, dishwashers, microwave ovens, vacuum cleaners, dirt devils, trash compactors, food processors, more. One picture showed a trim young woman in jeans, smiling knowingly down upon her daughter, who was blonde like Mom. The pretty tyke held a plastic baby in her arms and smiled down upon it. There were also large TVs showing men playing football, men playing baseball, men in racing cars, and grill setups beside which stood men with giant forks and giant tongs. Although it did not come right out and say so, the message of this advertising circular was clear. Women work and nest while men grill the kill. Evie rolled the advertising circular into a tube and began to snap the fingers of her left hand beneath the protruding end. A spark jumped at each snap. On the third one, the paper flared alight. Evie could grill, too.